You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Billy Campbell is the Chief Operating Officer for the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. As Chief Operating Officer, Ms. Campbell oversees program operations and is responsible for the timely production of deliverables, preparation of budgets, implementation of policies, internal processes, and monitoring the effectiveness of programs and progress toward agency goals. Ms. Campbell spoke at the November 11, 2009 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. The event was moderated by SSV board member Sue Lieberman.
I have a whole long thing prepared here to introduce Billy, but I've decided while sitting there that I'm really not going to read it, because she will tell you all you need to know about the planning district. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Billy. She holds a master's degree in public administration from George Mason University, and both a master of architectural degree and a bachelor of science degree in architectural studies from the University of Illinois. Prior to her career in public administration, she practiced for 20 years as a structural engineer and project manager, and still maintains her registration as a professional engineer. In her spare time, Billy is heavily invested in the Charlottesville community as a volunteer, and I've had the privilege personally to get to know her through some of our mutual interests. We're most fortunate to have her with us today. She's here to provide us with an overview of the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission and explore its working relationships with localities and public agencies, and to present some of the current programs and activities that they're involved in. Billy, it's all yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue, and thank you for having me here today. It's a real pleasure to be here. Sue and I have gotten to be pretty good friends because we're involved in a lot of activities together. I first met her through the Chamber's Aging in Place Business Roundtable, and we're still both very active in that. And then she went through Leadership Charlottesville, and I'm currently the chair of the Leadership Charlottesville Alumni Association, so we go to a lot of events together for that. And then a small group of women got together and did a three-month course on authentic leadership, and so we really had a chance to get to know each other there. So when Sue asked me, gosh, it seems like a really long time ago, to come here and speak to you, of course, I said yes, because Sue asked me. But I really didn't exactly know what I was saying yes to. And as the day approached, I was like, so what am I supposed to do? And then I got your letter, and it spelled out all of the past, or not all, but some of the past speakers that you've had. And I must say, it's a very impressive array. And when I read that, I must admit, it was a little intimidating that you've had congressmen and senators and delegates and former governors here to speak to you. So we at the planning district really are much more behind the scenes than the elected officials, but we do work with them. And what I hope to do today is to kind of give you a glimpse into some of the things that happen behind the public process, which is a little more front and center. We work very closely with elected officials, primarily local elected officials, and also other organizations and agencies at the state and federal level as well. So I just want to thank you again for letting me be here today. I just want to start with some basics, because the whole concept of what a planning district commission is can be just a little confusing. Most people confuse us with planning commissions, which are local bodies that make decisions about zoning and site plans and ordinances, and we are not a planning commission. A planning district commission is something unique and different than that. We were established through action by the General Assembly back in 1969. They established planning district commissions through the adoption of the Regional Cooperation Act. So we've just had our 40th anniversary of the institute of that act, which was put into place under Governor Linwood Holton. And every city and county in Virginia is in a planning district commission. The division and the boundaries of that were actually drawn before the act was put into place in 1968. And then in 1969, then the act was adopted, and it gave localities then the opportunity to come together. And so a planning district commission is actually a creation of local government, but it's encouraged by the state. We are technically a political subdivision of the Commonwealth. So the act spelled out what PDCs were supposed to do, and there's a little summary there on the slide, but let me read some of that to you. To encourage and facilitate local government cooperation and state-local cooperation in addressing on a regional basis problems of greater than local significance. The cooperation resulting from this chapter is intended to facilitate the recognition and analysis of regional opportunities and take account of regional influences in planning and implementing public policies and services. The Planning District Commission shall also promote the orderly and efficient development of the physical, social, and economic elements of the district by planning and encourage and assisting localities to plan for the future. And in fact, planning district commissions take a very long view. Most of the plans we do have a 20-year horizon. Some have a 50-year horizon. And so unlike planning commissions at the local level that are dealing with things that are current and development that is being proposed, we really are looking pretty far in the future to provide a framework for that planning. So this is a map of planning district commissions. Some are actually called regional commissions. Ours is the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. We're Planning District 10. So you might recognize kind of that phrase, because sometimes that's referred to as Region 10. It is the same geographic area that that Region 10 serves, also the same geographic area that JABA serves, as our Area Agency on Aging has the same boundaries. And there are other regional organizations that have pretty similar boundaries. MACA and JAUNT, the Thomas Jefferson Solid Waste Conservation District, have almost the same geographic area, except that Greene County is not part of that. Greene County is served by Skyline CAP as their community action agency, and by Greene County Transit for their transit program. I have to grab my water bottle, so let me just do that. This is a list from the Virginia Association of Planning District Commissions website about the different services that planning district commissions carry out. VAPDC is a statewide organization. Not every planning district commission is a member of that. Last year, they have an annual meeting every year in July and then another meeting in January, which focuses on legislation. But at last year's July meeting, they did give an award to Sally Thomas. I don't know if you saw the article in the paper about that, recognizing her for her long and effective work in promoting regional cooperation. So this is a list from the VAPDC website, and it's tended to represent the different kinds of things that PDCs do. Some PDCs will do some of these and not others. We do pretty much all of these things. We're having a strategic planning session with our commission tomorrow, and in preparation for that, our new executive director, Steve Williams, did a telephone survey with the different planning district commissions across the state, asking about their programs, their budget, their building, how their commission's put together, who really makes the decisions at their place, and to get a look at kind of what services there are. And some of the things that we found was that a lot of the planning district commissions around the state are more involved in economic development than we are. We have some involvement with economic development, but not very much. Most of our work focuses on land use planning, transportation planning. We administer the HOME program, which is a federal housing program. But we do environmental work, mapping work, grant applications. We do really the full array of these things. But this is kind of representative sample of the work that's done in PDCs across the state. So to bring that then to home, this is us, the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission. You can see the localities there. We serve the city of Charlottesville right in the middle and the surrounding counties, Albemarle, Savannah, Greene, Louisa, and Nelson. There are some incorporated towns, Scottsville, Louisa, Mineral, Stannardsville, Columbia, and in some PDCs, the towns are actually represented on the commission. Ours is not structured that way. We only have representatives from the city and from the counties. Our towns, three of them have a town manager, but two of them don't have any staff at all. And so they really don't have the capacity to participate in a very significant way in the PDC's work, but generally do that through their represented counties. So our Planning District Commission has a board, our commission, which is made up of 12 members. So that's two representatives from each of the six localities. And our charter and our bylaws require that more than half of the commissioners are elected officials. And so most of our commissioners are on the City Council or the Board of Supervisors. We have eight elected officials, both Albemarle and Louisa have two elected officials on our commission, so we have 8 out of 12. Our fiscal year actually runs July 1 through June 30th, but as we know that when elections take place, new elected officials take office beginning in January. So we are looking for some pretty significant changes on our commission when January comes and the local boards of supervisors have their organizational meetings and they designate the persons who will represent their locality on our commission. Sally Thomas has been a member of the commission almost as long as the commission has existed. She was part of the original formation of the planning district back in 1972, and she served as a citizen representative for Albemarle County for several years, took a break when she came back to the area, ran for the Board of Supervisors, and after her election was named by Albemarle County to serve as an elected official on our commission. So for us, thinking about what the commission will look like with Sally not on it is going to be really different. And in addition to that, two of our other commissioners, Jack Wright from Louisa County and Charles Albaugh from Fluvanna County, did not run for re-election this year, and so someone else will be taking those seats on our commission as well. So our mission is very much in line with what planning district commissions were created to do. We forge sustainable solutions to regional issues. And I like that word forge in our mission because it implies that solutions come with a lot of work. It takes a lot of planning, it takes research, it takes deliberation, it takes debate, it takes public participation, and it takes the kind of debate and deliberation of elected officials to come up with those solutions. But what we're trying to do is to put in place things that will work at a regional level, that will we deal with issues that really cross jurisdictional lines, and what we want is to have everybody win through the solution that we come up with. This is really, regional approach is really based on the all boats rise together kind of theory. And instead of trying to foster any kind of competition among the localities, really have them kind of raise their heads up from the day-to-day issues that they deal with in their localities and really look at the region as a region and the assets that we have and to capitalize on those and make the most of them. Sustainability can be a pretty loaded word, I think. Back in 1994, before my time at the Planning District, we had a Sustainability Council that was formed, and it was made up of community business leaders and political leaders and other citizens who came together to really look at the issue of sustainability. So it took years for them to come up with the accords. They had a wide range of them. They sifted through them, and they reduced them to these. These are posted on our website, but it's about respecting the natural environment, preserving farmland, preserving our natural heritage, looking at forest land, and conserving energy. So things that mean that we aren't just going to use everything up, but that it will continue to be able to sustain itself. So these were finally presented to the public on June 16th, 1998. There was a big ceremony. There were big boards that people signed to say they were in support of the sustainability accords. And so we had participation from all the localities. And these sustainability accords undergird a lot of our work. This is very important. We incorporate these as the accords into our work and the principles in almost everything that we do. So I just want to share with you a little bit about where our money comes from. The biggest area there, the kind of maroon color, is federal funding. We get a lot of federal funding, primarily through the programs that we do. There isn't any federal funding that just comes to us. It only comes to us because we do programs and we seek grants that are funded by federal funds. The biggest of those in terms of the federal funds that come in is actually our home program. And most of the funds, even though they come to us, we disperse out to the six localities, to the housing foundations that serve them. So you can see at the top it says including pass-through. And so out of our $2.5 million budget, about $900,000 of that is actually pass-through money that goes to the localities for housing work. We do get state funding. A lot of that also comes in the form of programs and grants, but our agency for the state is the Department of Housing and Community Development, and so out of our full budget, they give us a little bit less than $80,000. So it helps underwrite some of our programs because we don't have additional funding come in for some of our basic services, but it's a fairly small amount in terms of our overall budget. We also get money from the localities, and our localities give us money for a number of different kind of line items. The biggest is what we call the per capita contribution from the localities, and so we set a rate. It's currently 60 cents, and it's based on population, so they basically pay us 60 cents a person for a year. So that among the localities then contributes a portion of our budget. They also contribute specifically to our ride share program, which is a ride matching service. We have a legislative liaison who actually works for the localities but is housed at our office, and so they pay his salary also on a per capita basis. And we also manage for the region the solid waste management plan, which has several action items in it, and so they give us a small amount of money to carry out the items in the solid waste management plan. So altogether, the money we get from the localities is a little over $200,000. So between the kind of state funding from the DHCD and the local funding, that makes up about 20% of our budget, which means we have to go out and find the money for the other 80%. So we do have some longstanding programs that have continued. The Metropolitan Planning Organization is one of those that we've been providing the planning and administration work for a number of years, and so that's a very big program of ours and continues year to year. The housing program is the same, that we've been doing that for quite a number of years, and that will continue. But a lot of the money that we have is for grants that span a year or a few years. We also do work directly for the localities that they pay us basically as a consultant to work with them. So from a program standpoint, these are the things that we do. Of course, we do have a little bit of money that we use for the administration of our office to pay the rent, keep the lights on. And if you look at this, again, housing is the biggest program on here. But again, that is primarily due to the pass-through money. We only get to keep about $65,000 of the $1 million that goes through our office, and the rest of it goes out into direct housing projects. Transportation, if you were to take that pass-through money out, transportation would be our biggest program. So we have more staff members who work on transportation than on any other program. We also do environmental work. We do community plans, and we'll talk some more about those a little bit later. And overall, then, our expenditures last year were $2.6 million. If I called you on the phone from my office and you had caller ID, it would say Thomas Jefferson was calling. And I think that probably if some of these other agencies called you or organizations called you, it might say the same thing. And it's easy for people to get the planning district confused with some other organizations because they too have Thomas Jefferson in their name. I think the most confusion happens between us and the Thomas Jefferson Partnership for Economic Development called TJPED, and a lot of people really just interchange TJPDC and TJPED. They have it's hard to separate those because the acronyms are so much alike and because it sounds like very similar stuff. Even more confusing, when I came to the planning district in 1999, TJPED was co-located in our office. And we were at the same location and had the same address. They have since moved. Now they're at the Downtown Business Center. They do have a larger geographic area that they serve than we do. We have an ex officio seat on their board, and so we have some connection with them. When I first came in 99 was when the Workforce Investment Act had just been passed. It was going into effect in 2000. There was a lot of debate about where that program should land. The chamber was mentioned. The partnership was mentioned. We were mentioned. And there was a lot of discussion about where that would go. But at the time, Albemarle County was not a member of the Partnership for Economic Development, and that's a pretty big hole to have in the middle of your region to not have represented at the organization. So back in 99 and 2000, when the Workforce Investment Act was getting started, the decision was to have it housed at the planning district. And so we did that work for about 10 years. And in the meantime, there were a lot of changes at the partnership. They got a new executive director. Albemarle County did join as a member of the partnership. And so a year ago, in July of 2009, the Workforce Investment Program, the Piedmont Workforce Network, moved from our office to TJPED. And so that had a pretty big impact on our budget and our operations. Our staff person went over to the planning, to the partnership. And so we had a staff person who worked for us who primarily did work for us, and she moved over to that organization. And so we do have a lot of connectivity with them, but we are separate and distinct from them. Also, we sometimes get confused with the Thomas Jefferson Soil and Water Conservation District. They are primarily interested in the protection of natural resources. And so because we have an environmental program, sometimes it's easy to get that confused as well. I did a composting workshop with the Fluvanna Master Gardeners in the middle of October. Our job was to bring the composting bins to both give away in a raffle and sell, and also to bring the refreshments. But the Soil and Water Conservation District got credit for that instead of us. The Thomas Jefferson Foundation, of course, is Monticello. And it's not as easily confused with us, but we do find that sometimes we get their invoices and sometimes quotes that we get have their name on them because it's easy to get confused there as well. Our commission will be there tomorrow at the Jefferson Library for our retreat. And we do have, again, a relationship with Monticello as well. Thomas Jefferson Health District serves the same geographic district as us. They obviously are focused on health and have been in the news quite a bit lately because of the H1N1. We don't have quite as close a working relationship with them, but they are one of the partners, in fact, the lead partner, I think, in Local Motion to help people get out moving around and eating right to promote their health. And we have been involved in that effort because a lot of what we do is focused on building livable communities where people do have the opportunity to walk and bike and get out, and all of that contributes to health. We do our work in a variety of ways, and one of the ways is that we partner and collaborate primarily with local governments, but also with other organizations in the communities, with businesses and agencies. The organizations that I've shown up here are some, certainly not all, but I chose them because all of these organizations have had their beginnings at the planning district, and that's one of the things that's really important about the work that we do. We We are a resource because of our kind of neutral competence. We really are not a political organization. We're more of a technical organization, a consulting organization. And so we often provide kind of that neutral space. And because we look at things from a regional perspective, when there's a need that comes up, it's often incubated and housed and started at the planning district. So it was back in 1975 when Jaunt was established. Jaunt provides paratransit service, which is transportation services for people with disabilities in the urban areas, and also provides public transportation in the rural areas. And that was established through the planning district in 1975, so pretty close to when we started. We started in 1972. We also initiated JABA. In 1975, and so out of the work that was done at the planning district, then the Area Agency on Aging, JABA, was established in our region. And we've continued to do work that has spawned off other regional organizations. In 1989, we started the Thomas Jefferson Housing Investment Corporation, TJ HIC, and we did a lot of the things that we now do through the Home Consortium. Rehabilitation of substandard housing, down payment assistance, those kind of work in the housing area. And when that got started and began to grow, that actually developed then into the Piedmont Housing Alliance. So they are part of our home consortium now and do work through that program and are partners with us in a number of things, but obviously are a separate organization, a nonprofit organization, but one that we relate to in a variety of ways. In 2002, we got a grant to start a new citizen organization, which ended up being called the Alliance for Community Choice in Transportation. And they were housed at our office for, I think, the first 2 years, and then moved out on their own, have their own board, are a nonprofit organization, and they promote alternatives to transportation so that people have the opportunity to bike and walk. So one of their big programs is safe routes to school so that school children have a safe way to be able to walk to school. Also do a lot of promotion of bike programs and did a study on West Main for a possible streetcar there. TJAC is the Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless. We have provided staff support for them for 10 years. About 4 years ago, we started working on the 10-year plan to end homelessness. We had a task force for that and helped them write that plan. It called for a lead organization on homelessness. And after kind of floundering about for a bit, what happened was that TJAC, which was a loose coalition of service providers, decided they would become the lead organization. And so we worked with them to help recruit a board, to get them through the application process to become a nonprofit. And so now they've grown up. And they're about to leave home. They're still housed at our place, but they'll be moving into the Haven at First and Market, formerly the First Street Christian Church at the corner of First and Market Street in downtown Charlottesville. And they will become a real one-stop resource center, not only for the homeless, but for people who are at risk of becoming homeless or just have needs that aren't being met. So we continue to do that work to kind of build things up, and then, like good children, they grow up and leave home. So one of the other ways that we work, we provide kind of that table and that space for people to come. We bring people together. Sometimes it's small groups, sometimes it's large groups. One of the things that we do is called Mayor and Chairs, where on a quarterly basis, the mayor of Charlottesville and the chairs of the boards of supervisors for the other five counties get together. We had a space of 2 or 3 years where we stopped doing that. I think it was around the time we changed executive directors, and it kind of fell through the cracks. And when we started it again and they came together, one of the elected officials says, "Oh, this is like therapy." I mean, it was a wonderful thing to see how much these elected officials needed to get together to talk about issues that were common and to know that there were other people facing the same thing, and they had those partners and people who could understand exactly what their struggles are, because I think oftentimes elected officials feel like they're out on their own with a big target on their head. So it's good to have that space. But we also invite organizations and the community. Sometimes the character of the planning district and how we work is colored by what is the kind of prime area of expertise of the executive director. And so particularly during the term, the 6 years that Harrison Rue was our executive director, his expertise was really in the public planning process. And so we did a lot of public exercises. How many of you have come to any of the... Okay, so we invite people from the community. You can see people in the picture here. They're kind of working at tables. We have maps that they can draw on. We have PowerPoints that kind of educate people in the planning process. What we try to do is to equip people to intelligently participate, because it can be frustrating for citizens to think, I'm not sure if that's the right thing, but you really often can't participate intelligently unless you really have the chance to kind of be educated about the process and understand some of it. And so our public process is intended to do that. The other things that we do are to develop practical visionary plans and then assist partners with implementation and funding of those plans. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the Eastern Planning Initiative. It was a project that we started in January of 2002. It took 2 or 3 years, I guess, to finish that up. It was a project with a 50-year time horizon, so it was looking at development over a 50-year time frame. And it was structured to engage a lot of people into the process. And so we invited a variety of organizations, very diverse organizations, to send a representative. We had people from all of the affected localities. It didn't affect every locality in the planning district, but five of them, to come together and to participate in this process. And I want to share quite a few slides on this just because it really illustrates some of the planning principles that we put into play, and also it served as the foundation for some of the work that we do with other localities in the planning district. So the Eastern Planning Initiative really focused on kind of this concept of place. It takes something to make a place. It's not just a landscape that you would drive through, but a destination where you would get out, where you would have an opportunity to interact, kind of a public meeting place where people can gather and see each other. And so if we can focus development to create places instead of spreading it all over, it really gives the community an identity. And so some of the characteristics are having some open space. You have things that are happening close together. The kind of the size and character of the buildings fit together so that you get some degree of consonance. And there are connections both within the development and then with things that are around it. So we had a consultant who worked with us, and they actually developed some prototypes of what different places look like. And they used some real places in the Charlottesville and the surrounding counties to kind of make a prototype of what different kinds of places would look like. So this is an urban mixed use. They did these really nice diagrams to show what that, so you can see a lot of more dense development, more regular gridded streets, and a lot of things happening close together. Suburban mixed use, this would be something like Hollymead Town Center. This is northern Albemarle, where development was beginning to occur. And so you can see that it's not quite as dense, more spread out, but does have a mixture of uses. This is a small town. This is actually Palmyra. And this is actually a map of Palmyra that they used kind of as a prototype for what a small town would look like. And so what the study did was then it looked at kind of how those things existed, and then over a 50-year horizon, how they could develop to retain their sense of place and even enhance their sense of place. And so looking at the suburban mixed use, you can see then that more things would be put into place, but what you try to do is to create a walkable community. You can kind of see that yellow or that green circle there. That represents a 5-minute walking radius. So you can kind of get a sense that, you know, if we can pull these things together, actually create some walkable areas where you could park once and do a variety of activities. So the Eastern Planning Initiative was called that because it really looked at the eastern part of the planning district. So not all of Albemarle or even all of Green, but all of Louisa and Fluvanna. Nelson County was not part of the area, but they were part of the process because we reported to the commission and in 2002 when they had to do their update of their comprehensive plan, they actually used these prototypes to do their comprehensive plan. So even though they weren't part of the original study, they did benefit from the work and incorporate that into their own planning work. So it's a pretty big area, almost 800,000 acres, and at the current time when it was done in 2000, 160,000 of those acres were developed. So the dispersed scenario is really kind of a do-nothing alternative. This is if you didn't do anything to have development or transportation kind of occur in any kind of a planned fashion, if it just kind of continued the trend that was already in place, things would be pretty much spread out. And if you were to accommodate then the transportation improvements, there would be quite a number of roads and widened roads of the existing roads. And so one, part of the analysis was to take a look at what those transportation improvements would cost. So in a dispersed scenario where development was just happening wherever it happened, it would take $1 billion to build all the roads and to do all the improvements that would be needed. But when the groups got together and they looked at different scenarios, they looked at some different possible things and kind of came up with what was a preferred alternative, and that was to have centers. So you can see Charlottesville is a center, up 29 is a center, in Rutgersville, Standardsville area is a center. Also the town of Palmyra, Science Crossroads, and Louisa and Mineral in Louisa County. So when development happens in a more compact kind of node way, what that gives is the opportunity to consolidate your road improvements to handle that traffic. And when you take a look then at the roads that would be required, not only is it half as costly, but it also reduces the miles driven per day total across the whole region, and also the amount of congestion. So that's an important principle that kind of undergirds a lot of our work. It also gives the opportunity to start to consider transit as an option, because it can be more efficient if you've got people concentrated at different places, and then that makes more efficient routes. As part of the project, our consultants developed a tool called Core Plan, and it's to develop metrics and performance measures to take a look at the scenarios and see how they stack up. So they used the sustainability accords, they looked at the percentage of farms and forests, how much of the area was developed, how much of it was in cluster developments, gasoline and trips, as well as water quality and quantity. So you can see kind of the dispersed scenario and then the other scenarios, that the dispersed scenario uses up a lot of farmlands, takes down a lot of forests, impacts water quality, creates traffic congestion. But when you can do that more compact development, then the metrics show that it's a more sustainable model. So we've used this work from the Eastern Planning Initiative as kind of guiding principles and ways of measuring how different scenarios would work. We were invited by Fluvanna County to work with them and develop community plans in all their growth areas. So we've done Fork Union, Palmyra, Zion Crossroads, Lake Monticello, and then worked with them a year ago to help incorporate all of that work into their comprehensive plan update. We've done some similar things in Nelson County in addition to working with them on their comprehensive plan. We did a safety study in Lovingston, really looking at transportation safety issues. We did a community plan for them in Nellie'sford, right at the base of Wintergreen. And we're in the process now of finishing up a master plan for the village of Rivanna at Glenmore, out 250. This is another study, a transportation study, actually done by the same consultant who did the Eastern Planning Initiative, using a lot of the same methods and the same method of measuring. So this is just the northwest part of Fluvanna County. So you can see kind of a big red sun there. That's actually the Zion Crossroads area. And through that planning process, what the participants and the officials who were part of that process decided was that they really wanted to see Zion Crossroads as a place to really focus focused development. But it's not the only place. They also wanted to have some development around Lake Monticello so that at each of the gates around there that there are places to shop, possibly assisted living facilities so that people didn't have to move when they were ready to move into something else, but could shop. Okay. And then the blue down at the bottom is the village of Palmyra. And again, when you then kind of decide where you want that development and put things in place to help target development in those places, then that lends to transportation planning that can really link those things together and really make the most of the $2 of transportation money that we have to actually build anything. We're doing the same kind of thing right now in Greene County that's just finishing up. We're doing a multimodal corridor, which means it looks not only at automobile transportation, but also biking, walking, transit, to look at different modes of travel through there. So we're looking at Route 29. This is a piece of Route 29 and also 33 in Greene County. And again, are working with Greene County now to update their comprehensive plan to bring all of those things in so that it provides then that guidance for future development. Places 29 is a really large project. It's been in the news quite a bit lately because it's finishing up. Its process has been adopted by the Planning Commission and is going on to the Board of Supervisors. For us, this was a three-stage process that took about 6 years. We started looking just at the intersection of Hydraulic 29 and 250. We had consultants to work with us and to really look at that intersection and possible improvements, and then in phase two of that, refine those, actually did some of the design work, and phase three then was working with Albemarle County to look at land use and how that then would impact transportation. So this is a transit map because, again, when you concentrate development within certain corridors and nodes, then it provides an opportunity for there to be effective transit. So that's moving through the process now and is a very significant project for both Albemarle County and for us. So I want to shift now away from transportation and community development, talk a little bit about our home program, because one of the other things that we do for our localities is that we will work with them to seek different sources of funding and to help manage that program when that funding occurs. And one of our biggest success stories is the Home Consortium. This brings in funds from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. None of our localities would qualify for home investment partnership funds by themselves. They just don't have enough population. But HUD had a provision where if localities would come together and form a consortium that they could qualify for funds. And so this was established through the work of the planning district back in 1992. So we've been doing it for 17 years now, have brought in $15 million into the region over that course of time, primarily used to rehabilitate housing that has that is substandard, to provide down payment assistance, and also to develop rental properties. So that's been very flexible and stable money. We work through housing foundations in the different areas, the Favana Luisa Housing Foundation, the Nelson County Community Development Foundation, Skyline CAP, who serves Greene County, and the City of Charlottesville, who actually has a competitive process to award those, and Albemarle County, who primarily does their work through the Albemarle Housing Improvement Program. So that has been very important funding to come in. It's really helped develop the capacity of those organizations, who also then attract contributions from their localities. And when projects are out there and they're sold, some of that money comes back, and so there's program income, and so it does perpetuate itself. So that's been a very important and successful program. We do try to do some other things in housing. Every 5 years, we have to do a consolidated plan, which looks at all the housing monies that come into the region and coordinates those in some way. And that can be kind of a daunting process because oftentimes you don't have really good data to make choices. And so 3 years ago, the Housing Directors Council, which is the group that meets to manage the Home Consortium funds, got together and thought, that what we ought to do is to commission a study. And so we worked with the Center for Housing Research, which is located at Virginia Tech, and they used a lot of different data, sales of homes, migration patterns based on IRS data. They collected a lot of data and did technical analysis for us to really look at housing and to find out what's going on. So the report covered a wide range of things. This is one diagram that really looks at rental supply and looks at it at different income levels. This is three levels, 50 to 80%, so that's just under the median income of the family income in the region. And at that, we have enough rental properties. In fact, we have a surplus. But when you get lower down, 30 to 50% of AMFI, we find that there's already a shortage. There's currently a shortage of units. Partly that's because there aren't enough units, and partly it's because people who have greater income live in those units, because for the most part, you can't tell people they can't live there because they make too much money. But when you get onto the under 30%, so you're talking about the lowest levels of income, we currently have an almost 4,000 unit deficit. And so what that means is that people who at the lower income are paying 50 or 60% of their income for housing instead of 30%. So that makes some pretty tough choices when you're having to pay almost all of your income. And so this was a very important report. This is just one of the things. It also looked at home sales and special needs housing and other things. And this was just one aspect of the report. But it really gave us a lot of good data to work with. It was also used by the Joint City-County UVA Task Force in their work coming up with recommendations, and by IMPACT when they first started and were looking at housing. They used some of that research as well. So that was the purpose of that, was to kind of provide some quantitative data, because I think people knew qualitatively that there was a housing problem, but we just really didn't know exactly what it was or how serious it was, and this gave us the numbers to go along with it to help inform those decisions. We also sometimes seek out other projects and do reports and studies. We did a home sharing study, so that's kind of a golden girl approach of bringing people together. I think it's an arrangement that could work for people, but people don't want to just move in with somebody else. They want to make sure that they've been checked out and that they're okay and that the home they're moving into is fine. And so we did a feasibility study to see if a home sharing program might work in our area. We conduct focus groups and did research and looked at other models. And we did find that there was a need for that here. This is a pretty high housing area. And people I don't know that they are quite meant to live alone. What we found during the study was that there are actually health benefits to having companionship. And so not only does it reduce the cost of your housing, but also provides some important social interaction that really is meaningful to people. When we did the focus groups, we thought that there would be some people who would just kind of want to rent out their basement for the income. We didn't find anybody saying that. They all wanted somebody who had similar interests. They wanted to have some connection with another person instead of being isolated and alone. So we hope that that will come to some kind of fruition. We just finished that in July, and we'd like to move forward with that in some ways. But that's also some of the work that we do is research and studies. One of the tools that we developed over a four-year process is called the Transportation and Housing Alliance Toolkit, or the THA Toolkit. And what this does is it takes a lot of the planning processes that we already use and kind of documents what they are and tell people how to do it. I liken it to following your grandma around the kitchen to try to write down her recipes, because she never measured anything. She just put it together. And so a lot of what we do in planning, we do kind of as a matter of practice, sometimes intuitively, and so it kind of forced us to write everything down and organize it in a way so that other people, other areas, could take some of those planning techniques and put them to work. What we find is that doing that kind of a process is more inclusive. If you get a wide range of people to come, you really get to understand what their needs are. We also know that some people aren't going to come to a planning workshop. People with disabilities, frail elderly, low-income people who are working two or three jobs, they just don't come. And so it also provides tools for gathering data, making maps, so that you can involve the needs of people all across the spectrum in planning process, because what we want is to end up with communities that work for everybody. We've also done a design manual for small towns, came out of our work with Scottsville, a green building source book that catalogs different green building techniques to be environmentally friendly in construction, and the Heritage Tourism Toolkit, which actually won an award through the Association for Preservation of Virginia Antiquities, and was featured in Best Practices for Southern Tourism. Pulled together a lot of resources that we gave to different organizations in each locality about how to really capitalize on the historic resources that were in their areas. So that's not all that we do, but it's a lot of what we do, and I think gives you a good sense of how we work and what we do. We're not really that visible to the public, but we try to be very visible to our localities, to our elected officials, to the planning commissions, really work behind the scenes to help make their life easier. Often we are an extension of their own planning departments because they just don't have enough staff to carry out special studies, and so they work with us to do that. So. It's a little kind of backstage tour, I guess, of how some of the decisions and work is done for localities, and I hope it gives you a little bit better understanding of how some of those decisions are made. So we do have almost all of the studies that I've mentioned in here are on our website, tjpdc.org. There's really a lot of information there. If there's any of the studies or anything that we've mentioned, you probably can find it in downloadable form on our website. So we invite you to peruse that. So thanks very much.
Billy, thank you. One thing I neglected to do was in introducing Billy, her title is Chief Operating Officer, just so you know. That's an important thing to know, that, you know, she doesn't do the cooking either, but she can guarantee the quality.
Could you clarify the role of the TJD versus the Metropolitan Planning Organization?
I'll try. The Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission provides staffing support for the MPO. In fact, the executive director of the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission is also the director of the Metropolitan Planning Organization. So the MPO, Jerry can tell you all about this, is the official transportation decision-making body for the urban areas of the region. So that includes the city of Charlottesville and the urban ring in Albemarle County. The official body that makes decisions is called the MPO Policy Board. And the voting members of that are two members from Albemarle County and two from the city of Charlottesville. So just like I told you that the election was going to have a big impact on the composition of our commission, it's also going to have a big impact on the MPO. Right now, the city representatives are Dave Norris and Julian Talaferro, and so Julian is no longer on city council, and he will be going off. And the Albemarle County representatives are Dennis Rooker and David Slutsky, who's the chair, and so David Slutsky will no longer be in office. And the second... I think I said that wrong. I think Hooja is actually the other representative from the city, and he's contemplating going off. So it may be that three of the four of the voting members of the policy board may be changing come January. So we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. But they have also a technical committee, and then we do the staff work for that.
Could you talk a little bit about governance and how to take one of these larger projects like the transportation studies? Where does it come from? Where does the request originate? Do you have to have unanimous consent from your commissioners before you undertake one of these projects? How does that work? And finally, do other counties all have to weigh in and approve this? Or, I mean, what's to stop the Planning Commission from having a concentration in Albemarle County? Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of governance issues I think would be interesting.
We do have two, for transportation, I mean, the MPO is kind of the decision-making body within the urban areas. We also have a Rural Transportation Technical Committee, and the commission itself, the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, serves as the policy board for the rural transportation areas. So just like the MPO policy board kind of is the decision-making body, the commission is the decision-making body for rural transportation. We are required by the MPO to do a long-range plan and update that every 5 years, and so a lot of the projects are spelled out there, and going through that can highlight areas that need some additional studies, and so the MPO would be making decisions about what kinds of things to pursue and have the authority to approve grant applications and other things that would go in. We do the same thing with the rural areas through the commission. VDOT now requires a rural long-range transportation plan. We're actually finishing the first of those. It was three phases over three consecutive years and are getting ready to finish that up. And that also then identifies certain areas. We do, as a commission, try to kind of share the wealth and see what kinds of things are most responsive to development pressures that will lead into the update of the comprehensive plans, because each county is on a different schedule for that, or a five-year update. And so the commission does look around to kind of see that. Also, you know, we have to have something that's competitive. And so partly it's to look at what would be most likely to actually win funding. And so we have moved around. The corridor study that we did in Fluvanna, Northwest Fluvanna, was also actually involved part of Southwest Louisa. And Albemarle County, with their own local funds, did a Eastern Albemarle add-on to that, and that served as the transportation plan that then was brought into the Village of Ravanna Master Plan. We tried three times in Greene County to get funding because they were really feeling a lot of development pressure, particularly in the 29 corridor. So it took us three times actually to apply for that. So the commission does act as the kind of decision-making body for that. It's a very prepared group. They're very engaged in conversation and deliberation. It's very infrequent that we don't come to decision, that the commission doesn't come to decisions by consensus. I mean, we do have to have formal votes on stuff, but oftentimes it's a very congenial body, and so we're able to work it out that kind of benefits the region as well as the locality.
I wanted to raise a question about time horizons in long-range planning. I was surprised in your Eastern study that your time horizon was 50 years. 50 years. Mm-hmm. That amazed me. That's good. I'm impressed, but it's a big number. 2 years ago, your people, or one of these groups, I guess it was the MPO, had a meeting here, I think at the Senior Center, to have public review of the Hillsdale Extension project. And I attended. I looked at the posters, beautiful documents done by your teams. And I walked up and looked at it, and it shows projected usage in 2029. And I laughed out loud and asked one of the planners, and was told that VDOT had a 22-year planning horizon on highways. I think that's what I heard. You guys were required to go 22 years into the future on that. Again, a rather long time span. Now, what I want to point out is very simple arithmetic. There are only about 1,000 billion barrels of oil left in the world. The number might be 1,200 if we're lucky. Some people might claim 1,300. 1,000's a good working estimate. We currently use 30 billion a year, roughly. Some would say 28. It's down because the economy's down. Nevertheless, you do the division, the answer is 30 to 40 years. And you've got planning horizons of 20 plus years and 50 years in here. And the energy's going away. You won't have traffic jams. So unjam 2035 is nonsense. And in fact, your problem is actually going to be down which street will the next trolley line go. That will be the real problem in that time period. In fact, the next conclusion I draw is that since paying off the bonds for these slabs of concrete will take decades, it follows immediately that the construction of most of these highways is a very bad public investment. I'm curious on your comments on time scales.
Oh, I'm sure my executive director should answer that question. You bring some important points, and transportation planning, I think, has been inordinately focused on the automobile. We are starting to see some shifts in that, that our long-range plans now have a very strong component for pedestrian as well as bicycle and transit, because we recognize that the automobile is not going to be the only mode of transportation, and that's why kind of these multimodal studies are what we're seeing more of now, to really look across the whole transportation spectrum. Predicting anything 20 or 50 years out is a little bit of an exercise, but sometimes it does start to raise those questions that when you look at development patterns, that if we don't make any decisions otherwise, everything's going to be spread out so much that nobody will be able to get anywhere. They won't be able to walk, they won't be able to ride their bike, and they won't be able to drive. And so we can at least look at kind of that broad brush scenario to see what it is we want and to use that to inform some of the development patterns more than the transportation options, to give ourselves as much opportunity to put some transportation systems in that will actually work.
I'm impressed with the breadth and depth of the projects and work that you do. The question is about who hires people and how many staff do you have?
I think we have 15 staff, and the reason I'm fuzzy about that is because on our payroll we have people who are technically not employees of ours. The legislative liaison, for instance, really doesn't work for us. He works for the localities, but it was just impossible for the localities to each pay a piece of his salary without having some central place. And so he's on our payroll. The director of the Fluvanna Luisa Housing Foundation is actually on our payroll, because when that started, it was Fluvanna and Luisa as two separate organizations. In order for him to have a whole salary and benefits, we had to act as that agent. ACT staff, we talked about the Alliance for Community Choice and Transportation, have two staff people, and they're on our payroll. And TJAC's executive director that just started in August is also on our payroll. So I think we have 20 people on the payroll, but I think only 15 of them are actually ours.
So how do you get appointed or hired?
What is the process? We are required to have kind of a public process to advertise for the position and to interview people and to select the person most qualified. We have just hired a new environmental planner. We just went through the process and people applied and we interviewed him. So it's a fairly normal, I guess, process. We can't just pick somebody we like and have them come. We do have to go through the process of actually looking at it, and it's the same as procurement. You know, it's a fair and open process, and so we really take all comers, and sometimes we're surprised at how it turns out, and we get better person.
Like, part of what I'm asking is, who do you report to, and what is that hierarchy that would hire a person at your level?
Well, you know, I didn't come in at this level. I came in as the assistant to the director. I was interviewed by the executive director, and the executive director, by our bylaws, is the person who can make the decisions about staffing, hiring, and firing.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. In your own opinion, do you think mass transit will ever come to this area? I mean, I think it's the answer to a lot of our problems.
So when you say mass transit, can you tell me exactly what you're thinking of?
Like a bus route up and down 29 into some of these communities?
Well, we have some bus routes that go up and down 29 now.
Not from here to Hollymead.
Okay, not this far out, you're saying.
Right. Oh, yeah. We have a pretty good system here in the city, and maybe a little bit further out, but not down into Albemarle. It's really a mess.
Well, we are working now with both Charlottesville and Albemarle on the possibility of establishing a regional transit authority, because there are two things. One is, you know, being able to pull it off and actually build what needs to be built or buy the buses and equipment that need to be in place in order to have a system. And the second thing is being able to have a system that would attract riders. That's the biggest nut, is that we all like to drive our own cars. I drive my own car from Earliesville. and so partly there's a shift in people's patterns of being willing to ride the bus. We did a project just this past year. It was called the RTA Toolkit, and it was to develop a series of surveys and other ways of gathering input to begin to evaluate what the demand was, what routes people were interested in. So we're just finishing up that study now. And part of the intent of that was to develop these instruments that other localities could use. But that helps to define where routes would be most in demand, so that it informs kind of that whole decision process to say, where should we look next. So we do have a public transportation system of some kind, you know, mostly in the urban areas, with just Jaunt providing public transit in the rural areas. And so they do have commuter routes that come in from all of the outlying counties into Charlottesville. But you're talking about something that's more robust and is actually a transportation option for a good number of people. Right. So, you know, it's an incremental process. So, you know, I can only say that we have pieces and parts of it now, and that it's not going to be an explosion overnight, but something that we build.
What I'm asking you is, do you think it will ever happen, in your opinion?
Well, I'm finding that, you know, now in Earliesville, that there are things that are closer out to where I am, that there is seems to be a little bit of shift in development toward the northern end of Albemarle County. You can actually go out to eat up there. And so I think as we see a greater concentration of development there and destinations and residences, then transit starts to make sense. So I think it's possible, but it might be a 50-year time frame. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I know that there are 25 planning districts, and only 22, I believe, are in the Planning District Commission.
Yeah, actually 21 and 19, I think, are in the VA PDC.
Mm-hmm. So what is the difference?
It's just an organ, like an association of any kind. It's kind of like a professional association. It's the VA PDC just provides an opportunity for executive directors to get together, for transportation planners to get together, for us to learn from each other and act together to try to influence in the way state agencies, that when they put something out, you know, what we find is that, you know, they'll put out a proposal and there'll be a cap. And if you apply as an individual county, that's the cap. And if you apply as a region, that's the cap. Well, that kind of stuff does not promote regional cooperation. So if we can work with state agencies to kind of think in a more regional way when they put out RFPs or when they undertake projects, that's helpful, I think, for the localities and for the regions. And the VA PDC is a place where that happens.
What I'm trying to see is what ones of the planning districts, 25 planning districts for area agencies on aging and groups like that, there are 25 planning districts. Which ones are not involved or have been kind of merged to come into the Planning District Commission?
Well, there are 21 Planning District Commissions in the state, and I think 19 of them are part of the VA PDC. I'm not sure which two are not. I think it's more a question of personalities than anything else. And the PDCs are just as much a PDC as anybody else. They still do what PDCs do, but they just don't participate in the statewide organization.
And then I have a little hardball question. what
Have you all studied the Eastern Bypass? And if so, what are your recommendations?
It has been studied in a variety of forms. I talked about the kind of the 29 corridor stuff that we've been doing over a series of years. There is a 29 corridor study now underway, and I think that was one of the proposals which, I don't know, created a great public outcry, I think, and maybe it's off the table. I don't have a personal opinion about it. I'm not as involved in transportation planning as some of our staff.
I think the Eastern Bypass goes up into some of the rural areas. It's not around 29.
Well, I know, but that was kind of part of their trying to figure out how to fix 29 was to take some of the traffic off. And the other bypass has kind of really fallen by the wayside in terms of support by VDOT or the MPO. You know, we're just looking about to try to find ways to reroute the traffic somewhere else. And so any transportation improvement that disrupts anything is problematic. You know, it's used to be NIMBY, not in my backyard. Now it's banana. Build almost nothing anywhere near anything.
It's true. Would you be interested in hearing an idea of a through expressway, an elevated expressway over the Southern Railway right away to take the through traffic from the south of here to the north of here and not even stop in Charlottesville to separate, to eliminate congestion?
Yeah, I think in terms of kind of transportation decisions, the composition of the MPO and the decision makers on that are going to make a difference about what kinds of things are on the table and what things are considered. We provide staff support, so we're not the ones making the decisions. We're providing as much information, analysis, relevant maps, other kinds of information so that the decision makers can make good decisions. But the Planning District Commission itself is not the decision-making body. So we're open to any kind of ideas, but in the end, it's not our decision.
As you said earlier, there is a study of a whole 29 corridor going on between North Carolina line and I guess the Washington, D.C. area. And then you have other studies going on more locally, like the Places 29 study. Do these kinds of things tend to work against each other sometimes? Are they pretty well coordinated, or what is the case there? And the second question is, what percentage of the MPO funds are provided by VDOT?
How about I answer the second question and leave the first one off? There is some attempt at coordination for the large corridor study, and so representatives of different organizations come periodically to review what the consultant has done and comment on it. So our executive director has gone to some of those corridor meetings to hear things. He's only been here since May, and so he's involved in that process. So there is some attempt at coordination, but there's also, you know, a different group of people doing the studies, and so there is sometimes a disparity between what they're including in their study and what this area would think would be the best transportation solution. MPO funds for us come in two sources. We get money, it's federal money that flows either through VDOT, the Department of Transportation, or through the Department of Rail and Public Transportation. The VDOT part of that is the bigger part. It's about three quarters of the funds. 80% of the funds are federal, 10% are state, and then 10% are local, and so we use the money that we get from our localities to serve as that local match. So it's essentially an 80-10-10 split.
So then most of the money is funneled through VDOT?
The planning money that we get, yes. Yeah. I mean, our money that we get is for the planning work.
Yeah, I'm still concerned that there may be a lot of conflict going on between the studying types of things you do, like Places 29, and what VDOT is doing.
VDOT was a full and active partner in Places 29. VDOT funded the majority of that study. So
I'm just concerned about a waste of planning money here, where it seems like too many people have got their fingers in the pie. Different things going on at different times.
Sometimes just looking at the public process for making decisions seems inefficient, because you have to look at all kinds of alternatives. You have to have a certain amount of public input. You put any two people together, they're not going to agree on everything. And so there's always some inherent conflict. And the decision-making process in the public arena, because of that kind of required deliberation and debate, can sometimes be painstakingly slow. But it's important for us to hear opinions and to consider alternatives that are different in order to come up with a solution that actually is going to stand the test of time. So even though it seems like, you know, that there's a lot of conflict and differences of opinion, it's important to really air all of those and weigh them before you spend a lot of money building a big road. It's a lot of money.
You also spend a lot of money in the planning process when you have all these people involved. That's, I think that my own personal opinion is when the MPO and those kind of organizations were created, they created a situation where you have many, many people at odds, and there's a lot of waste of taxpayers' money going on just in the whole delaying process.
I understand, you know, from the outside that it looks
to do what
very convoluted.
Originally intended to do.
Yeah, and that when I changed careers from being an engineer working for a private firm and got my master's in public administration to move into the public arena, we spent a lot of time in the MPA program talking about the difference in the decision-making process in a private setting and the decision-making process in a public setting. It's tempting to want to compare the two and say just make an executive decision and move forward, but the public system requires that everybody gets to weigh in. I mean, elections are pretty darn messy. But that's the way it works. It's the public process. It's how democracy plays out.
Who referees the discussion about these sorts of things? I'm thinking very small. We had a gone thing going in our neighborhoods here where there were neighborhood groups had allocated money to for repairs, quote, and they got wheel bumps to slow down the traffic pork chops. Anyway, then it turned out they hadn't really followed the rules that they had due in their discussions. Mm. And that was never covered afterward.
Well, I mean, we serve kind of that role, that kind of facilitation and bringing people together. So the planning district serves that role for some decisions, not every decision. Some decisions are made, you know, separately by individual localities or neighborhoods. We don't necessarily get to that level, but we do some of that. But sometimes, you know, it's just a knockdown, drag out fight. Time's up? Yes. All right. You guys are so cool.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.